Today is Tuesday, January the 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, the fifth wave of the coronavirus pandemic continues across the world, infecting both the unvaccinated and vaccinated alike. U.S. President Joe Biden tells Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that the U.S. and its allies will respond decisively if Russia again invades the Donbas region in southeastern Ukraine.
And the U.S. position on this has been pretty consistent, which is that anyone is welcome to apply to join NATO, and no country can unilaterally say, hey, you can't join. They can't block anybody. So they have to go through the process.
Sudan's Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok resigns after mass protests against a deal he made with the military in October.
The transition in Sudan is very, very difficult. The structure or the military structure that Bashir left means that structure is very strong.
And former President Donald Trump and his two oldest children face subpoenas in an ongoing civil probe into the family's business practices. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, U.S. President Joe Biden told his Ukrainian counterpart, President Volodymyr Zelensky, that the U.S. and its allies will respond decisively if Russia again invades the Donbas region in southeastern Ukraine. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that Biden reiterated his support for Ukraine amid Russia's massive military buildup along the Ukraine border, including discussions over what the White House calls the Ukraine Confidence Building Initiative.
The Ukraine Confidence Building Initiative is a USAID project that's been working in the Donbas region of Ukraine. It's basically like a civic democratization initiative, and it has three goals: basically to increase acceptance of Ukrainian civic identity based on common values, to broaden participation in Ukraine's reform process, and to build trust and acceptance of objective pro-reform information. And so what you could take from all of this in the context of this call is that the Biden administration has said that they want a diplomatic path out of conflict. They want to address challenges around the world with diplomacy, with information, with confidence building measures. And that is basically exactly what they're doing here in Ukraine.
As we know, with the Biden-Putin talks, Putin was saying to Biden that, you know, he wants to see no further expansion of NATO in Eastern Europe. Did Mr. Biden and Mr. Zelensky talk about that?
According to the limited information we have of this call between Presidents Biden and Zelensky, they kind of just touched on NATO and touched on the fact that NATO is going to be having talks coming up in the coming week, but didn't say anything specifically about Ukraine's ambitions to join the security alliance. And the U.S. position on this has been pretty consistent, which is that anyone is welcome to apply to join NATO, and no country can unilaterally say, hey, you can't join. They can't block anybody. So they have to go through the process. But they didn't mention this at all in this readout of this call. It was almost certainly talked about. That's one of the big issues. And Putin has been very clear on this, but it doesn't look like they reached any sort of firm resolution against it or in terms of like satisfying Putin's demands.
Can you refresh our memory and tell us what are the upcoming meetings that are happening between the U.S. and some of the European powers?
Sure. So in the coming days, we're going to have three sets of high-level talks, none of which are going to involve, we think, the heads of state. But these are high-level talks between like senior foreign ministry officials. First of all, we have coming up the bilateral talks between the U.S. and Russia. Those are going to be very interesting. Those are going to be held in Geneva, and those are not going to include either president. Then we have talks with the NATO-Russia Council, which are, of course, multi-party talks, and then more talks at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which, again, is a multi-party organization. So the U.S. is going to participate in all of these and hopefully, I guess, try to find some sort of path forward that doesn't escalate into conflict and bloodshed.
That was VOA White House correspondent Anita Paul speaking with Carol Van Damme. Former U.S. President Donald Trump and his two oldest children are now facing subpoenas as part of an ongoing civil probe into the family's business practices. AP's reporter Saga Megani has more.
New York Attorney General Letitia James has issued subpoenas to the ex-president, son Donald Jr., and daughter Ivanka. James's office says it wants testimony and documents in connection with an investigation into whether the Trump Organization misled banks or tax officials by inflating the value of assets. The Trumps are expected to try and quash the subpoenas, which would set up a legal fight like the one last year after James saw testimony from Eric Trump. That ended with a judge forcing him to speak with James's investigators. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The fifth wave of the coronavirus pandemic continues moving across the world, infecting the vaccinated and unvaccinated alike. The newest variant, Omicron, has already led to thousands of flight cancellations in the United States in the new year. U.S. President Joe Biden has promised to make available a half a billion rapid tests as American school children return to class. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
More than 9,200 U.S. domestic and international flights were delayed or canceled on New Year's Day due to bad weather and surging cases of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. That's according to the flight tracking website FlightAware.com. By Sunday, another 2,200 flights met the same fate. Chicago's O'Hare Airport was packed.
Last year, I was traveling. There was no one here, which was kind of eerie. So I like to see the people, but this is a lot of people.
While the Omicron variant appears less likely to cause severe illness, U.S. President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, warned spiking infections threaten the entire healthcare system.
Even if you have a less of a percentage of severity, when you have multi-fold more people getting infected, the net amount is you're still going to get a lot of people that are going to be needing hospitalization. And that's the reason why we're concerned about stressing and straining the hospital system.
As school children in the U.S. return to classes this week, Fauci's message remains clear.
I plead with parents to please seriously consider vaccinating your children, wearing masks in the school setting, doing test-to-stay approaches when children get infected. I think all of those things put together, it's safe enough to get those kids back to school.
New York City's new mayor, Eric Adams, who was sworn in on Saturday, tells ABC's This Week that the nation's biggest city is ready for school to restart.
We're going to create a safe environment with testing. We're going to identify the children that are exposed. We're going to remove them from that environment. The numbers show the mere fact that a child is exposed in a classroom does not mean that an entire classroom is exposed.
Adams takes office as New York City grapples with record numbers of cases driven by the Omicron variant. Classes resume Monday there and around the country. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
In Australia, conservationists are blaming climate change, land clearing, and pesticides for the population crash of one of Australia's most famous insects. Once a common sight, bogong moths have become rare in recent years. They are now recognized as endangered by the world's leading scientific authority on vulnerable species, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. From Sydney, Phil Massa has more.
Bogong moth is native to Australia. The mass migration of billions of the small insects has long been a spectacular sight in eastern Australia. Scientists say the moths are guided by the stars and the Earth's magnetic fields. They fly up to 1,000 kilometres from Queensland to the mountains of Victoria to shelter in caves from the heat of summer. In the caves, it was once estimated there were as many as 17,000 moths per square metre. But Jess Abrahams, a nature campaigner from the Australian Conservation Foundation, says bogong moth numbers have collapsed.
It's a dramatic decline, and this population crash has been caused by climate change-fueled extreme drought in their breeding grounds in western Queensland. There's also been land clearing over many years, use of pesticides as well, and the consequence is a huge crash in numbers, and the flow-on effects to other species is of huge concern. This should be an alarm bell because we're in the midst of an extinction crisis. We're seeing million species globally at risk of extinction, and literally these things are disappearing before our very eyes.
The decline of the bogong moth has a cascading effect on other species. They were a major source of food for another critically endangered animal, the mountain pygmy possum. Fewer than 2,000 of Australia's only hibernating marsupials are thought to be left in the wild. The moth is one of 124 Australian animals and plants that were added in December to the Red List of Threatened Species, compiled by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. They include several other types of insects and the grey-headed flying fox, which is Australia's largest bat. The Red List classifies how close global animal, plant and fungi species are to dying out, and include sharks, rays and birds. Many populations are strained by global warming, deforestation, habitat loss and pollution. Campaigners are urging the Australian government to do more to save the moths that were once in such abundance in cities such as Sydney and Canberra that their vast numbers disrupted sporting events. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In Lebanon, thousands of people in middle and low-income housing have been deprived of public housing loans since 2018, when the Public Corporation for Housing announced that it no longer has the funds to grant housing loans due to the economic crisis. From Beirut, George Eid reports that the Housing Corporation closed down temporarily because it was short on staff.
It has been almost 3 years since Lebanon's Public Corporation for Housing has stopped issuing housing loans. This governmental institution, on which many Lebanese once relied to secure a housing loan at an affordable rate, was the first to be affected by the country's deep economic crisis. Most low-income individuals who entirely relied on the loans it offered has been left with no options. Tony Yunus, who lives in Beirut, was getting ready to get married and had secured a deposit on a house while waiting for the Public Corporation for Housing to approve his loan, when he was informed that the loan will never be approved. He says, I was in the process of buying a house when I was informed that the public housing loan has been stopped. This was a terrible news. I had to postpone my wedding date and my plans as I lost the house. Recently, Lebanon's Public Corporation for Housing has announced that it will shut its doors until further notice because it was short on staff that allow it to process the active housing loans. The chair director general of the corporation, Ronnie Lahoud, explained that desperate times call for desperate measures. He says, we at the Public Corporation for Housing are overloaded with work because of the unfinished projects and the paperwork of the active housing loans. This is why we decided to close down temporarily. However, we are working on an overall housing plan that we hope would enable us to restore the housing loans again. The absence of the public housing loans has affected more than 65 other sectors at least, from real estate developers to building materials retailers. Alain Jewish, who lives in Beirut, is the owner of a sanitary equipment showroom. He explains that since less people are buying homes, his business activity has dropped by more than 60%. He says, ever since public housing loans were halted, less people are buying building material. Our business has decreased dramatically. Many real estate developers have gone out of business, and this has affected us deeply. As Lebanon's financial crisis deepens, hopes to revive the public housing loans are fading day by day, while the Lebanese government has yet to address more urgent needs, the least of which is providing electricity and water to citizens around the country. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
In other news, gunmen unsuccessfully attempted to assassinate Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry during an event on Saturday commemorating the Caribbean country's independence. Prime Minister Ariel Henry's office said on Monday that bandits and terrorists had tried to shoot the Prime Minister at a church in the northern city of Gonaives, where the ceremony marking the 218th anniversary of independence was taking place. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, Upfront Show, Africa 54 TV Show, Straight Talk Africa, and others. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The European Southern Observatory reports that scientists have spotted a group of at least 70 planets that do not orbit stars and are free-floating in space? Rick Pantaleo has more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you think of planets, you probably picture them orbiting a star. But did you know there's a classification of planets called rogue, orphan, or nomad planets? These are planets that are much like those in our solar system, but rather than orbiting any star and being part of a planetary system, they are free-floating in space. Not many of these reclusive planets have been found, so they are considered to be quite rare. The European Southern Observatory reports that scientists who use several of their telescopes as well as other facilities have spotted at least 70 rogue planets that make up what they consider to be the largest group of orphan planets in the Milky Way. It's believed that these objects have been ejected from their original home planetary system at some time in the distant past. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International edition continues. Sudan's Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok resigned Sunday after mass protests against the deal he made with the military following the October coup. Political analysts say Hamdok's resignation is a blow to the country's political stability and hopes for a return to a civilian-led government. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's African News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
In a televised address to the nation, Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok said he was resigning to make way for another person to lead and called on a comprehensive dialogue to end the political crisis that has engulfed the nation for 2 years. Hafez Kabir is a Sudanese political commentator. He says Hamdok's resignation leaves the country in a difficult situation.
Sudan will go for a new crisis because there are many military groups, there are many political forces, their opinion is not the same. The money threaten the Sudan and its unity, and there is many problems also in economic side, social side. So we want a new initiative for solution, for a comprehensive solution that can save the situation in Sudan.
Kizito Sabala is an expert in diplomacy and international relations. He says Hamdok's resignation proves that it is difficult to block the military from the country's politics.
The transition in Sudan is very, very difficult. The structure or the military structure that Bashir left, it means that structure is very strong, and therefore for Sudan to move forward, a lot of work must be done to ensure that they delink politics from the military, which is a long, long process that will take so many years. It also implies that any support that the military has been having through the good international standing of Hamdok is going to fizzle out.
In October, army officers pushed out Hamdok's civilian-led government. Military Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan defended the military action, saying it was to prevent the outbreak of civil war. Hamdok signed an agreement with the military rulers in November, but the Sudanese population questioned the prime minister's power after he was reinstated. Shakur Nyaketo is a journalist and activist. He says new blood is needed to lead the civilian side of the government.
The political parties are still on argument. They are not actually together. Now they are thinking of reforming their political parties, and they want to come up with one national front so that they can clear up their faces with the communities and with the public. But the public does not trust the political parties. So the public right now, they are asking for civilian government that should be formed from technocrats, not from the political parties.
Sudanese youth continue to march in the streets against the military, and the protests are consistently suppressed through force. On Sunday, thousands marched, demanding that the military get out of politics. According to Sudan's Central Doctors' Committee, 2 people were killed. The military has been cited as saying it will permit peaceful protests and hold those responsible for violence accountable. So far, 57 people have been killed since the military seized power in October. The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Africa Affairs issued a statement on its Twitter page after Hamdok resigned, urging Sudanese leader to set aside differences, find consensus, and ensure continued civilian rule. The United Nations Sudan representative Volker Perthes issued a tweet Monday saying he regrets Hamdok's decision but respects it. Sabala says Sudan is at a crossroads and international pressure is required for the military to ease its grip on power and accept the country's need to move to a democratic phase. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned violence targeting protesters in Sudan and called upon Sudanese security forces to exercise restraint. He also asked them to respect Sudanese rights to freedom of assembly and expression. The Secretary General also encouraged all stakeholders in Sudan's transition government to continue engaging in meaningful dialogue in order to reach an inclusive, peaceful, and lasting solution.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta led the country in mourning the death of world-renowned Kenyan paleoanthropologist and conservationist Dr. Richard Leakey. Dr. Leakey was recognized for his campaigns to stop poaching in Kenya, famously burning the country's stockpile of poached ivory. He died on Sunday evening at the age of 77. Maureen Ojambo reports from Nairobi.
Over the years, Dr. Richard Leakey served Kenya with distinction in several public service roles, among them a director of the National Museums of Kenya and chairman of the Kenya Wildlife Service Board of Directors. In his message of condolences, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta said that besides Dr. Leakey's distinguished career in public service, he is celebrated for his prominent role in Kenya's vibrant civil society, where he founded and successfully ran a number of institutions, among them the conservation organization Wildlife Direct. Dr. Leakey is known for his strong stance to stop poaching in Kenya.
We can burn ivory and do all these things, but unless we can persuade the public why we're doing it, we'll be wasting our time. Ivory must be seen as only valuable if it's on an animal. It should not be ever seen as a valuable commodity for trade.
Leakey's groundbreaking work contributed to the recognition of Africa as the birthplace of humankind. Leakey followed his parents' footsteps in paleoanthropology, the practice of seeking to understand human evolution by studying fossils and ancient tools. In his 20s, Leakey made his own important findings, and in two groundbreaking books, Origins and the People of the Lake, he explained the emergency of Homo erectus, an ancestor of modern humans.
It's a natural heritage site with evidence of prehistory, not just of the ancestry of humanity, but the ancestry of the African fauna is better represented there than anywhere in the world.
From 1968 to 1989, Leakey was director of the National Museums of Kenya. In 1989, he was made director of Wildlife Conservation and Management Department. Devoted to the preservation of Kenya's wildlife and sanctuaries, he embarked on a campaign to reduce corruption within the Kenya Wildlife Service, crack down on ivory poachers, and restore the security of Kenya's national parks. In doing so, he made many enemies.
If we do not release the energies of Kenya by being able to move about effectively and cheaply.
In 1993, Leakey survived a plane crash in which he lost both his legs. The following year, He resigned his post at the Kenya Wildlife Service, citing interference by then-Kenyan President Daniel Arap Moi's government, and became a founding member of the opposition party called SAFINA. However, his political career was unsuccessful. In 1998, he was appointed by Moi to head Kenya's civil service in charge of fighting official corruption. The task proved impossible, and he resigned after 2 years. In 2015, as another elephant poaching crisis hit Africa, President Kenyatta invited Leakey back to Kenya Wildlife Service, this time as chairman of the board, a position he would hold for only 3 years. At the time of his death, he was serving as chairperson of Turkana Basin Institute at Stony Brook University in the United States of America. Leakey died on the same day with his best friend, whom they served together at the Kenya Wildlife Service, Charles Njonjo. It's on record that Leakey is the only man in Kenya that Njonjo trusted. Leakey was buried in Rift Valley yesterday, Monday evening. Maureen Ojiambo, VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
South African investigators say a fire that destroyed significant parts of Cape Town's historic parliamentary precinct Sunday may have been caused by arson. Police say they have arrested a suspect who was found with stolen goods. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
Brigadier Nomthandazo Mbombo from the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation, also known as the Hawks, listed the charges against the suspect.
A 49-year-old suspect was arrested and charged with housebreaking and theft, arson, and will also be charged under the National Key Point Act. The suspect was allegedly caught with suspected stolen property after he gained entry to the Parliament precinct in Cape Town unauthorized. He was spotted by members of the Protection and Security Services when they noticed the building was on fire.
The National Key Points Act deals with safeguarding certain installations against sabotage or other hostile acts. Natasha Mazone, the chief whip of the main opposition Democratic Alliance Party, spoke outside the Parliament gates.
We now know that the water sprinkler system was turned off, so clearly it was a designed destruction of our Parliament. As I look up, I could cry, and what gives me hope is that the statue of Madiba stands strong and was untouched by the fire. And he's looking on as we rebuild, and we will rebuild, and we will be a better parliament than we were before.
By Madiba, she was referring to the late South African president, Nelson Mandela. Officials, including Cape Town's mayor, offered potential meeting sites for parliament.
Mayor Jordan Hill-Lewis, the mayor of Cape Town, has offered his city council chambers as well as the city hall, which seats over 1,000. We also have the virtual platform, which we all become very used to. But sit we will, and hold the government to account we certainly will.
Public Works Minister Patricia de Lille addressed the media at a briefing at Parliament Monday afternoon.
The temperature inside the building is still plus minus 100 degrees Celsius, down from what it was yesterday at over 400 degrees Celsius. But what they've done in the meantime is to use a drone that they are putting inside the building to assess the structure of the building until the temperatures can cool down.
She said a team of engineers has been brought on board and will focus on the repairs that need to be done, the cost and the time it will take for completion. De Lille said they've also brought in a fire expert who will determine exactly where the blaze started, together with a fire forensic team.
We are being informed by the professional teams that we can expect a preliminary report by Friday morning about their preliminary findings, and that report will then be shared also with Madam Speaker and the presiding officers, and we will then decide together what to do. And once we've seen the full extent of the cost,
the suspect is due to appear in the Cape Town Magistrates Court on Tuesday. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.